For 15 years, Michael Gargiulo has been convicted of murdering two young women. He's also been convicted of a third attempted murder and officially charged with a fourth.
There were multiple murders that were associated, you know, with his arrest and suspicions that he might be tied to another murder back in Illinois.
So what drove Gargiulo to commit such acts of depravity? Why did he commit his brutal and sadistic murders?
There was a great deal of blood all over the bedding, all over the linens and the pillowcases. So it was an extraordinary amount of violence.
Psychological criminologist and former FBI agent Dr. Brianna Fox is examining the life of Michael Gargiulo to try to understand how he became this monster.
My work isn't just academic. I've been in the field and sat across from serial killers. I've tried to apply my experiences to work out just how these seemingly normal people become the monsters that they turned out to be.
Were there early signs that he would descend into a spree of killings? And could police have caught the man who would become known as the Hollywood Ripper earlier, before he embarked on his trail of destruction?
I'm Dr. Brianna Fox, and this is Descent of a Serial Killer.
Dr. Brianna Fox is a former FBI agent and psychological criminologist, and now works as an associate professor at the University of South Florida at Tampa. She is an expert on psychological behavioral analysis and offender profiling.
Michael Gargiulo is a serial killer whose advanced knowledge of forensics helped him evade police capture. I'm delving into his past alongside my fellow experts in an attempt to spot any red flags that were along his descent to murder. Michael Gargiulo was born in February 1976 in Glenview, Illinois.
Glenview, a suburb of sprawling Chicago, located about 10 miles northeast of O'Hare Airport.
It's a solidly middle to upper middle class community, not a lot of poverty.
One of seven children, his family life was reported to be troubled.
He was often bullied by his siblings as well as his father. There's a report that he was made by his siblings to watch them torture and kill animals. So we're not talking about run-of-the-mill, developmentally appropriate bullying or interactions between family members. We're talking about chronic, severe abuse. We're talking about him being left in a closet alone for days at a time. His father would punish him in bizarre ways, tying his hands together as a child, holding them over a hot stove burner until his hands blistered. And it even went so far as to reporting that the father hit him with a baseball bat or a golf club. Injuries to the head, very significant to remember when you're looking at any type of history and violence.
It appears that Gargiulo lived a normal life, but inside, there's a storm brewing in this guy. And it's an evil, dark storm. He just seemed kind of distant, dark, and like this angry, brooding kid who could snap in an instant.
There's a commonality in backgrounds among serial killers, and some are made, you know, by trauma and exposure to terrible things that children should never see. You take a person that has that innate need for power and control, pair it with some key life experiences that might be traumatic or might just model, you know, violence. And now you've, you know, hit the switch in a house that was already wired for it.
Gargiulo experienced serious and consistent physical and psychological abuse during childhood, perpetrated by not only his parents, but also his siblings. The stress and physical effects of this would have impacted Gargiulo's psyche in a negative way. His short temper and anger towards the world would have been the most obvious manifestations of this.
As Gargiulo grew up, he started to fit in more socially and attended the local high school.
He seemed to fit in. He was a good-looking guy. He was tall and seemed to have no trouble getting girls, or at least getting contact with girls.
Mike was an exceptional athlete, and he made the football team. As a young high school student, I believe he was a freshman, and he was exceptionally skilled, but he had anger management issues, and he had authoritarian issues, and he wasn't very responsible. He wouldn't show up on time for practices. He didn't make the cut because of that, and he was always a very poor student for a lack of effort. It wasn't that he wasn't bright or intelligent or didn't grasp material, he just didn't seem to care.
One of the things that was really significant that from the very beginning is that his friends would always describe him as a very quiet kid until he wasn't.
His friends report him having a hair trigger temper, a kind of flip the switch personality, that at one moment he could be a great guy, played baseball, people knew him, got along with him, but he could go into a rage, an incandescent rage at any moment.
And when he raged, it was a Jekyll and Hyde, absolute 180 degree shift into violent rage from an early age, around 13.
Just like night and day, he could flip and become this guy who just was explosive, angry, in bursts of rage, and a guy who claimed that he was gonna get whatever he wanted and nobody was gonna stop him.
And that kind of hair trigger personality is one of the dangers when people are crossed or thwarted, that they're going to flip that switch.
Those are red flags, but then you look back and he did have a criminal record. He was arrested for theft once. So that shows he's not afraid to break the law.
It is very likely that Gargiulo's experience of childhood abuse and trauma led him to be hyperreactive to threats and may have led to his reputed hair trigger temper. While we cannot fully diagnose Gargiulo without a thorough clinical evaluation, he did display many signs of antisocial conduct related to disorders from childhood into adulthood. On the 14th of August, 1993, the suburban peace of Glenview is shattered by an incident on Huber Lane.
The body of 18-year-old Patricia Picaccio is found dead on her doorstep.
Tricia's brother was a friend of Gargiulo's from high school, so this is someone known to the family.
The young woman who was celebrating her high school graduation and had returned home, had her keys in hand to open the door when she was stopped and killed on her own doorstep.
She was out that night. She came back from a party about 1 a.m.
Her arm was twisted behind her back and broken, as if someone had seized her that way and gotten control of her in that fashion.
Patricia's father was the person who found her.
He spoke years later, of course crying at the memory of the fact that the first thing he saw lying there were her little tennis shoes before he saw her murdered, butchered body.
Glenview is a small town. You know, I hate to use the cliche, everybody knows everybody, but it's a small town. So then you have this beloved girl in this town, young girl, who's found brutally murdered. What does this do to a small town like that? It sends a shockwave through it. People internalize it. They take it personally because, wow, this happened here?
Despite an extensive, detailed investigation, police failed to identify Trisha's killer.
Gargiulo actually brought flowers over to the family. And he started to come around the family more and try to get involved with them, getting close to them. And they even thought it was strange that he did this because it was just something he wouldn't do.
Mike Gargiulo lived with his family right around the corner. They lived less than 100 yards away, one block over from that, the home where the murder occurred. So relatively quickly, Mike kind of came under the microscope, and he was looked at and dismissed as being a suspect.
Clearly, the police are talking to him as a potential suspect or person of interest. But Gargiulo's like, hey, it's not me, but hey, there's this guy I know, right? And he, like, had this gym bag, and he wanted to get rid of this gym bag. He was going to bury it. He's essentially trying to throw the focus onto somebody else, and he was successful.
Gargiulo inserted himself into the investigation after Trisha's murder. This shows the morbid fascination he had with murder and the effect of the crime on the loved ones left behind. He also showed considerable interest in the police investigation, following it far closer than other people in the local community. While Gargiulo was on the list of people who knew Trisha, police did not believe him to be a suspect. Gargiulo did not come to law enforcement's attention in connection to any attacks during his teenage years in Glenview, but his criminal record began to grow.
And as they get into the age where they're, you know, having relationships, maybe they're a teenager now, that's when you might start to see the fusing of sexual and aggressive impulses in their relationships.
Typical mischief that all young boys get into trouble with, but his was a little extraordinary. He and a couple of friends would dabble in residential burglaries, and they were breaking into vehicles and stealing property out of vehicles.
Apart from his petty crime record, police were now increasingly thinking of him in connection with the murder of Trisha Picaccio.
And now, with all of this prior activity, the Cook County Sheriff's investigators are now really starting to focus on Gargiulo. Actually, it's that more intense scrutiny on Gargiulo that causes him in 1998 to then leave that area of Illinois, and he followed his brother Ken to Los Angeles.
It wasn't long after that murder that Gargiulo came to California. His brother already lived here, and he decided that he would evidently get himself out of the reach of the law's scrutiny after that murder.
Gargiulo goes to Hollywood, you know, with all these big dreams of being famous, being a big actor. He gets a job as a bouncer. Friends described Gargiulo as a clean-cut guy, good-looking guy. He had no problem getting the attention of females.
He did get a bit role as a boxer and seemed to fit that role. He had sort of the body of a boxer.
And maybe seeing all the glamour that's out here and being this close to people who may have had a real shot at some kind of Hollywood career might have enticed him and frustrated him at the same time. He spent some time working as a bouncer at a place in Hollywood. He got fired for slugging a customer, but before that he had confided to another employee something about leaving that bitch on the steps. And in retrospect, people saw that as a reference to the 1993 murder of the high school girl.
So one of the things that we're seeing is somebody who actually has a big ego. He also has a lot of disinhibition because he's perpetuating these crimes, but that he's also comfortable enough with a couple of drinks in him to actually tell people that he's killed someone.
Gargiulo met his first California victim, Ashley, not far from where she shared a little place behind Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood, of course. Ashley's life seemed to be on an upward trajectory. She was studying fashion. She had friends who were in the Hollywood business in a serious way, in a real way.
He was at a party one night that Ashley was at, and a lot of people at that party say he didn't take his eyes off her. Now, not that here was this good-looking guy who was interested in her, but here was this guy who was obsessed with her. There's a difference. And then one of her friends reports that she rolls up on the apartment one night, and there's Michael Gargiulo sitting out in his truck in front of her apartment. One of Ashley's friends actually questioned Gargiulo about sitting in front of her apartment the night before, and he says, well, yeah, I can't go home to Illinois because the FBI is looking for me and my DNA for a murder out there. And then Gargiulo lifts up his pant leg and he shows the guy a knife he has strapped to his ankle.
This is really creepy. Like, I don't want this guy around here anymore.
Ashley wasn't interested in Gargiulo. She'd become attracted to someone else.
She had met the actor Ashton Kutcher and had made a date with him to go out Grammy night in 2001, first for dinner and drinks, then he was running late, so he said, look, let's just have drinks. Police were able to establish the window of the time of death for Ashley is that she'd spoken on the phone at 8:30 with Ashton Kutcher.
He was running late. They were in communication with each other. She told him, hey, I'm in the shower. I'll be ready by the time you get here.
And then he shows up at her house at 10:30, knocks on the door, gets no answer, looks in the window and sees on the floor what he thinks is spilled wine. He'd been to a party there not long before, and presumably people had been having a good time and some wine was spilled. And so thought she might have left already because he was late and got back in his car and drove off.
But the marks that Kutcher saw were something far more sinister than wine stains.
Ashley Ellern was found by her friends and roommates in their shared home, lying in a huge pool of blood. She had been stabbed 47 times, with one blow being so severe it nearly decapitated her. Many of the wounds were over 6 inches deep.
Stabbing is very personal. There's a lot of closeness between the killer and the victim.
This was overkill. And the profilers always talk about this kind of savagery as indicating some incredible fury going on in the mind of the killer. Police later said that the windows were closed and locked, the doors were locked, and that it was very likely that whoever got in the house was someone who was known to Ashley, because she wouldn't have opened the door to just anyone else. People are young and a little bit naive, but if you're in California, you're pretty savvy about some of these things, and you don't open the door to just anyone.
His whole life at this time is essentially a lie. He's now not an actor. He's now working as a repair person for an air conditioning HVAC company.
Gargiulo's false persona and pathological lying are textbook red flags in the descent of a killer. He's trying to make himself more important, more interesting, and thereby more desirable to the women that he is attracted to. His choice of job as an air conditioning repairman is very interesting. By choosing a job which allows him access to potential victims' homes, he has a reason to be involved in potentially very personal situations, the same way he managed to insert himself into the family of Trisha.
As soon as Ashton Kutcher found out that there had been a crime committed, he went immediately to the local police station and told them, hey, I was there. My fingerprints are probably all over that door. Immediately put a lot of focus on him. And of course, because we're very tabloid driven here in the glamorous city of Hollywood, it pulled a lot of attention. And unfortunately, it probably pulled some necessary focus away from the crime itself and getting connections made about other possible victims.
Ashley's friends, family, and those closest to her are, of course, questioned first. But a common theme comes out of this. Many of them talk about this creepy air conditioning repair guy who was hanging around the building, who seemed fixated on her.
police, of course, started by questioning people she knew and people she may have known. And a name came up, but only a first name. Nobody knew the name of the heating and cooling man. But her friends remembered him bragging and talking about, you know, getting away from trouble somewhere back east, that he was a wanted man, and showed them a knife that he wore strapped to his leg, and that he would sit outside their apartment, their little place, sometimes night after night, just sitting there and watching. And she hadn't taken it very seriously, nor had pretty much anyone else until all of this happened. But no one knew his last name. There seemed to be very little physical evidence to help out the police. He hadn't raped her, so there was no DNA there. There seemed to be no DNA in the apartment, nothing that could have made a connection with anyone.
Gargiulo shows typical signs of psychopathy and narcissism, and that his bragging and grandiosity, even about the horrific crimes he committed, show his concern for himself and not his victims. He also has such little emotion and empathy for his victims, something that allows him to kill completely innocent strangers.
And Michael Gargiulo's murder spree is far from over.
The level of violence shown in these attacks reflects an anger and hatred that was likely generated from his traumatic childhood, an unresolved anger that continued to grow inside him. How could someone so despicable ever attract others to him? Remember, psychopaths are equally charming as they are vicious and unempathetic. So it's very likely that Gargiulo's charms won many women over, and then his true colors sadly came through.
Continuously operating one step ahead of the law, Gargiulo moves to another part of the Los Angeles area.
4 years later, he has moved to a suburban town called El Monte, which is a considerable way from Hollywood and a very different working class kind of neighborhood. He's living in an apartment complex with a girlfriend who moves out, and someone who moves in not long after that is a beautiful young woman, the mother of four children. She's from Central America, very attractive and catches his eye.
Maria Bruno could never have predicted what was about to happen.
10 days after Maria Bruno moves into that apartment complex, just across the corridor from Gargiulo, he sneaks in through a window and he brutally murders her.
My partner and I arrived to the crime scene within about an hour. What we saw was a really nice, new, incredibly clean, well-kept apartment. And in the master bedroom, the bedding was disturbed. You could see the sheet and the pillowcases and the pillows were somewhat not in an orderly fashion on the bed. And Miss Bruno was on the bed. She was lying on her back. The bed was soaked in blood. There was a great deal of blood all over the bedding, all over the linens and the pillowcases. There was some blood on the nightstand next to the bed and the lamp. So it was an extraordinary amount of violence.
Her throat had been slashed, and she had been stabbed several more times throughout her body.
She was found also with multiple stab wounds, but more viciously, she was also found with her breasts removed and one of them placed over her mouth. There's a lot of different psychologists that would tell you a lot of different things about that, but it seems to be making a statement. I'm going to take your femininity away from you, and I'm going to take control of it, and I'm going to shut you up.
That's a very personal, very visceral attack, and it reflects the ambivalence he felt towards these women. The fact that he doesn't rape them, but he's going for pretty women, and it's extremely violent, does not negate a sexual motive. You know, for him, the sexualization of violence may be all that's involved, that it is a sexual act for him. It's an act of intimacy to penetrate the victim with a knife. And it may be as simple as the fact that I possess them by taking their lives.
Gargiulo's fantasies that his female victims were in fact his girlfriends suggest that he had a need for connection and attention that went unfulfilled. He created a fantasy relationship, and their eventual rejection made him angry to the point that he would stab women multiple times, not just to hurt, but to kill. A common theme across each of Gargiulo's horrific murders is that he absolutely brutalized these women and showed pure misogynistic sadism.
But this time there is a clue. Outside her apartment, someone finds one of those thin, paperish blue booties of the kind that medical professionals wear in operating theaters. And on it is a speck of blood.
On the pavement, in front of the front door, was a blue cotton bootie, a shoe covering, like a doctor would wear in a hospital or like a repair person would wear inside of a house.
One of the things that helped Gargiulo be successful in these particular murders is that he started using surgical booties. They're mass-produced surgical cloth and elastic contraptions that fit over people's shoes. They're very easily put on, they're very easily discarded, and they're used for sanitation reasons. We also see them used in the perpetration of crimes because that's a way that you can keep from leaving footprints or any dirt or identifying evidence that may be on your shoes.
We really didn't know if it had any bearing on the murder or not, but we wound up diagramming and photographing and measuring it and maintaining it as a piece of evidence.
That's the first physical evidence that seems to connect Mr. Gargiulo to these cases.
Gargiulo moves again, this time to Santa Monica.
First he's in Hollywood, then he's in El Monte, and now he's in Santa Monica. Santa Monica is one of the places, when you say Southern California, this is what people see in their mind's eye. It's a beach. It's beautiful people on the beach. It's palm trees. It's open-air cafes. Everybody thinks they want to live in Santa Monica. And here we have Gargiulo, who had moved all across the greater Los Angeles area, from Hollywood to El Monte, and maybe other places in between. But here he is in 2008, living in Santa Monica, with his wife and his wife's mother on the same street that his next murder victim would be attacked.
Michael Gargiulo was unique in terms of his behavioral pattern, which included stalking his victims beforehand. That allowed him to learn their habit patterns and put him in a position where he could find them isolated and perpetrate his violence.
He entrenched himself in the neighborhood so that he didn't seem out of place. He worked as a handyman, so he had access to these different apartments. He surveyed and clearly observed the easiest way to get into people's homes, whether it was window, whether it was door, or making acquaintances with the young women.
Looking at the crime scenes in these cases, it's apparent that this killer knew what he was doing. If you're able to get into someone's apartment without breaking in and stab them inside their apartment and leave them inside their apartment without discarding the body somewhere, you're a pretty confident killer. And he did get away with some of this for quite a while.
It tells us that the sophistication that went into it, the planning, which really helps out when you're talking about murder in the first degree.
And it isn't long before he strikes again.
Michelle Murphy was alone, asleep in her apartment, a two-story apartment building in Santa Monica. She woke up with somebody on top of her trying to kill her, stabbing her in the chest with a knife. And Michelle wound up fighting back, fighting for her life, really courageous. And she wound up scaring her attacker, and he fled out the door of her apartment.
Michelle Murphy now, she's very petite, 5'1". She's up against Gargiulo, and he's stabbing her, and she's grabbing at the knife, and it's cutting her hand.
But she manages to kick Gargiulo off the bed, and he flees the apartment.
The difference this time is that there is evidence.
Gargiulo also gets stabbed, and he bleeds. Michelle Murphy threw this serial killer off of his game, off his fantasy, and he now is just discombobulated. He doesn't know what to do. So what does he do? He runs out of there. But he makes that mistake. He leaves blood at the scene.
she's a hero in this whole story. Were it not for Michelle Murphy, I don't know that we would have solved this case.
Seemingly insignificant things can actually hold a lot of weight. In this case, Gargiulo being shoved off of one of his victims, not expecting that she was going to have the physical strength that she had, and then responding under his breath with a mutter of, "I'm sorry," is really noteworthy. It's noteworthy because it shows us that in his brain, he went to a place of, "I can apologize for this." Maybe not even conscious. On some level, he knew he was doing something wrong. He knew he was doing something brutally wrong and attempted to apologize for it.
Michelle's bravery in fighting back against Gargiulo was incredible. And the cut he incurred, leaving his DNA in her apartment, is ultimately what helped police crack this case.
Now, the DNA profile, which is generated from the blood at the Murphy scene, finds a match from the past.
Detectives from the Santa Monica Police Department ran the DNA through the national database, and boom, they get a hit. It's Michael Gargiulo's. He is caught.
And then it's just a matter of finding him. Finding Gargiulo was harder than you would think, because this is a man who never put his name on a utility bill, who never put his name on a lease. They were always in the names of his wives or his girlfriends. And so it made it that much harder to find him.
Clearly, he took as much precaution leaving a paper trail as he did to the physical evidence. Police discovered he was more forensically aware than they believed possible.
Gargiulo bragged about being well-schooled in forensics and that he could never get caught for committing murders.
Gargiulo took great pains not to leave any physical evidence behind, those surgical booties. And for years, he'd been telling people that he had a great interest in forensics and that he knew that he would never get caught if he ever did anything.
It's very interesting that Gargiulo bragged to his friends that he knew a lot about forensics. Maybe he was watching shows, maybe he was reading true crime, but that probably led to his preparation for using the surgical booties on his shoes. What this does indicate is that he had enough savvy to put plans into place and to be able to control himself long enough to make sure all of those aspects were in play.
The narcissism makes them think they're smarter than everybody else and can get away with it. And the psychopathy, the absence of conscience, the failure to learn from consequences, you know, frees them from the inhibitions to act out. So if you've got narcissism and psychopathy, you know, they may see other people that have gotten caught, but they think they're going to be different and better. And who cares anyway? I want to do what I want to do when I want to do it.
Despite making incriminating statements, I believe Gargiulo never thought he would actually be caught. His narcissism and grandiose sense of self, as well as his belief that his counter-forensic measures would keep him unknown forever. It shows how crucial the development of DNA has been in solving crimes and how it will continue to be in the future. There are many red flags in Gargiulo's life, which should have indicated that he was on a downward descent. First, he experienced psychological and physical abuse as a child. And while this alone is not predictive of any future behavior, when it's combined with his grandiose sense of self and low affect, that could combine to form this extreme lack of empathy, which he showed towards the world and, of course, his victims.
In 2008, Michael Gargiulo had attempted to kill 27-year-old Michelle Murphy in Santa Monica. And it's there that his seemingly never-ending trail of death began to come to an end after leaving his DNA at the crime scene. Ashley's neighbors in Hollywood provide a crucial tip to link Gargiulo to her case.
The cops who were looking for this connection instead found a traffic report that he'd hit a dog nearby. The dog's owner insisted on filing an accident report. The owner of the vehicle was Michael Gargiulo.
Police show Gargiulo's photo to Ellerin's housemates. They identify him as the creepy stalker from before.
Your neighbors will talk. The big difference in having a homicide in an area like Hollywood or Beverly Hills is you have witnesses or people that want to help. They want to help solve the case, not like in other areas of town where they're reluctant to get involved.
One of the people that was very familiar with Mr. Gargiulo was the LAPD Hollywood Division homicide detective, Tom Small. And he had been on Tom Small's radar because Tom Small was investigating a murder that had occurred with a very similar fact pattern. Her name was Ashley Ellerin. She sadly lived by and had a mild acquaintance with Mike Gargiulo. So Gargiulo had come across the radar screen of the LAPD detective, Tom Small. When the Santa Monica officers got the DNA hit and they connected that DNA hit to the offense in Chicago, they also connected it to Tom Small's murder.
In 2008, Gargiulo is arrested for attempted murder and held on a $1.1 million bail. A search of his car produced a bag of tools, which they theorized that he used to get in and out of these places, but it also produced one of those blue slippers.
The Santa Monica Police Department Detective Rich Lewis did a great job. They wound up getting the blood from the suspect and developing a profile right away. They identified him as Michael Thomas Gargiulo. And in doing the background, the Santa Monica detectives realized that, gee, this guy lives right down the street from where Michelle Murphy was attacked. And in looking at his prior addresses, they saw that at one point in time, he lived in the city of El Monte. Well, they connected the El Monte address to the murder that I was investigating. And so they wound up calling me.
Police have enough to charge Gargiulo.
Gargiulo was charged with the murders of Ellerin and Bruno in September of 2008.
It would be another 3 years before prosecutors in Cook County, Illinois, felt they had enough to indict. Finally, in July 2011, Michael Gargiulo was charged with the 1993 murder of Tricia Picaccio.
Once Mr. Gargiulo was arrested, it took 11 years to get him to trial. That's a record in Los Angeles County, which is already kind of a slow place to get to trial. He filed more than 100 motions. He fired attorneys one after another. He wanted at one point to represent himself. And I have to say that judges in California do not look well on defendants representing themselves in death penalty cases.
Gargiulo's trial got underway in May of 2019.
The case of the attempted murder of Michelle Murphy was overwhelming. And that case, anybody would have convicted Mr. Gargiulo on that case. His attorneys as much as confessed and admitted to the jury that Mr. Gargiulo was responsible for that. Because the other offenses for which he was charged, the murder of Ashley Ellerin, the murder of Maria Bruno, the murder I investigated, there were so many similarities to that murder with the attempted murder of Michelle Murphy. All of that evidence was presented. The motive behind it, the modus operandi, the method that he committed the murder, there were like 45 similarities between Michelle Murphy and Maria Bruno and Ashley Ellerin and Tricia Picaccio, 17-year-old girl that was murdered in Illinois.
It seems that there were three pieces of evidence that were really key to breaking this case. One was that there was finally a survivor. Michelle was able to give a great description of her experience and what he looked like, as well as Gargiulo leaving one of his surgical booties at the scene of the crime that was later matched to one that was found in his attic. The most damning evidence in this case, though, were that two friends were flown in from Chicago, and they testified that Gargiulo had told them that he had engaged in murder.
The judge in Mr. Gargiulo's trial would later say, everywhere Mr. Gargiulo went, death and destruction followed.
Mr. Gargiulo almost assuredly would not have stopped doing this. He likes it. He lives for it. His life revolves around this conduct. He's a sexual psychopath.
In all of these cases, Gargiulo could, if he wanted to, could have sexually assaulted. That's not what he was interested in. And that is very unusual for a sexual serial killer. That's why what we really have with Gargiulo is a thrill killer. The sexually arousing piece is in the stabbing, is in the slashing, is in the hacking. That's what gets him excited.
He's a bad, bad, evil man. I've been a detective almost 35 years. I've been a policeman 42 years. I have been around and met and seen and worked with really, really bad, evil, black-hearted people. And if he's not number one on my list, he's right up there. He is as evil as anybody I ever met, I ever worked with, or I've ever even heard about or read about. I absolutely believe that Mr. Garjou is responsible for other murders or assaults. Somewhere between Chicago and Florida, or Los Angeles and Chicago, there are unsolved murders, most likely involving attractive young women, which were the people that Mr. Gargiulo preyed on, that we haven't identified yet.
What were the red flags in Gargiulo's descent to murder?
If we look at this case as a whole, we can see that there were several red flags along his descent. First, he had this propensity to turn on people that he cared about, even when they had done nothing wrong to him. He also involved himself in police investigations and developed an extreme understanding of forensics. He showed violence towards people close to him, including his spouse. None of these were enough at that time for an arrest, but to raise the flags that indicate that much worse was possible.
So were there sufficient warnings to police about Michael Gargiulo? Could law enforcement have intervened before he did what he did?
I don't believe police could have caught him earlier. Without the evolution of DNA, with him being so forensically aware, and the evasive maneuvers that he took to cross jurisdictions and evade capture, it really exploited the holes in the criminal justice investigations.
In Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal Lecter said, "We covet what we see." What did Gargiulo see? Every time he moved, he saw women, attractive women, women living on their own, women independent of men. And how that struck him, we don't know. As an opportunity, certainly. As a challenge, maybe.
There's a sense of having a one-up over their victims, a sense of the hunt and a predator that is closing in on his prey. So for many stalkers, there is a sense of power, control, dominance that is fueled by the pursuit pattern.
What most people don't realize is that the pathway to violence is absolutely an evolutionary process. No one ever snaps. There is a slow progression, sometimes a quick escalation, but that quick escalation into violence is always precipitated by years and years of preparation or being pushed or led into those acts. But that being said, never forget that there's always room there for a choice. There's always room there for a choice to make another decision.
Some of the red flags here are the anger, the creepiness, the way he would obsessively stalk people, the way he could go from 0 to 1,000 in an instant. These are all red flags that something's going on with this guy, and it's definitely not good.
It's really hard to say where in the trajectory of his life anybody could have had an effect on preventing these crimes. If he grew up in a disinhibited household that engaged in violent behaviors with each other, who's going to be the one to guide him away from things like this? We can ask ourselves, could anybody have done anything? Could there have been an intervention at any point in this criminal's trajectory to stop it from happening or to keep it from happening again?
Gargiulo has been found guilty of 2 murders plus 1 attempted murder, and he is currently charged with the murder of Tricia in July of 2011.